This reading is by the Bob Janice Dillon. Time happens so quickly. By the time something is happening, it feels like it's almost over. One moment links arms with the next, spinning in time's square dance. Each moment too gallant to refuse the next moment, taps their way in. Of course, your turn, my dear, says the present to the future, and wanders off to the sidelines, standing there in that poorly lit hallway of nostalgia, waxing rhapsodic to its buddies about what was and could have been over cold punch and cookies. This month, our theme is memory. We are asked, what does it mean to be a people of memory? What does it mean to be a person of memory? Most of my memories are like ghostly shimmers. I can barely hold them. As my mind reaches, they slip away. However, if I begin to speak or write them, that ghostly shimmer gains flesh. In the summer, when I was between the third and fourth grades, my family made bricks. My younger brothers and I would have heave two or three shovelfuls of dirt onto this heavy wire mesh with tiny, small, diamond-shaped holes held taut by 2x4s over a 3-sided plywood box that was just our height. The dirt would mound onto the mesh, some moist and dark, and some was beige and flaky. We would push that dirt back and forth across the mesh with our hands. At first, it felt soft and silky, and then it fell through into the collecting box below, leaving behind tiny bits of dry grass and weeds and stones and hard clots of dirt. If we were in the mood, we would press those clots across the metal like cheese on a grater, and the soft dirt would fall through beneath. Other times, we would just tilt that mesh and the debris would fall off into the rubbish pile. The dry, hot eastern Washington heat stretched the air so thin, and it smelled like crispy dust. Sometimes my job would be to fill the cement mixer. I measured the correct amounts of dirt, dry cement, something that was powdery white, and water all into the scratched, old, green-gray cement mixer. And then I would turn it on, and it rolled and it grumbled, turning its contents into this really thick mud. The men would fill these brick forms, these metal brick forms, with mud, and then they would take this big lever that they would squeeze it down so the form compacted the mud into a firm, solid brick. The trick was always to get the brick out of the form and placed, dried up so that it, before it crumbled. And then they would dry. Once I was on mixer duty, as I dumped that powdery gray cement into the mixer, and it puffed back up into my eye. And I still remember how full and gunky my eye felt. I don't remember crying out, but I certainly must have. I do remember someone saying, "Open your eye, open your eye." But I wouldn't. I was afraid. I knew that powder was cement, and if you mixed cement with water, it would get hard and it would seal like the walls and floors of my house that when the cement truck had come the year before. And so I kept my eye closed. And I remember how uncomfortable it was, how yucky it felt. And I remember being so afraid. And I remember my mother's arm around me leading me toward the house. Clearly, eventually, my eyes opened and got flushed out. I don't remember that part. I don't remember if it was red or irritated, but I can almost feel that. And I do wonder, did I get out of work for the rest of the day? Was I able to scamper off somewhere cool to read, my eye red and swollen? Did I think perhaps my parents would learn that children should not work all the time? My mother also has a ghostly memory of cement in my eye. She only remembers that they flushed it out with one of the hoses lying around for all that brick making. She is surprised, however, at the shared memories my brother and I have of long days making bricks and doing other chores in the heat. It's not like that at all, she says. We would get up at 6 a.m. before the heat hit and make bricks for a couple of hours and go in for a big brunch, do some chores, and then we'd go to the lake for the whole afternoon. We did not make bricks all summer, maybe a month. I do remember the lake. It was and it really is one of my favorite places. The water's so cool and there's big, tall, shady cottonwood trees. And I have memories of that as a child, swimming in it alone, trying to swim across, splash fights. But every afternoon, all afternoon, I really don't know if I believe that. Most of us have come to believe that memory is something like a photograph. It is like a fact and solid like a rock. And memory is nothing like that, it turns out. Memory is instead a story that we tell ourselves about our lives. We build these stories around things that happened, but our story shapes those things that happen. So what we actually remember expresses our worldview and our perspectives. Our story creates our truth. It does this in several steps. First, we perceive a situation. Perception is all the sensory data we take in when something happens. Like right now, you hear my voice, someone coughed, there's your chair, there's how your skin feels. And we can't possibly take in with our brains all the sensory data in this room right now. We just can't. There's too much. So we attend to particular pieces of data based on our interests, our attention span, previous experiences, and emotions. To take what happens in a given moment and remember it past the next minute, we can remember a lot in 1 minute, but then it goes into long-term memory, and we have to encode it. And how our brain encodes memory is incredibly complex, and they mostly don't really understand it very well. But it seems to encode through associations. We sort things into ongoing stories that we're already telling ourselves. Perceiving and encoding memory is not a photograph. It's a creative act. It's much more like a painting, and some of our memories are a little more expressionist painting than others of our memories. But it's really interesting because memories get even more creative. We even create more after we initially encode them. We add more details afterwards from conversations, thoughts we had, things that happened later, our particular attitudes. Daniel Schachter, who is a memory researcher, doesn't call memory photographs or even paintings. Instead, he calls them jigsaw puzzles that are assembled from many pieces. Every time we pull up a memory and give it form with words, we actually create the memory all over again and re-encode it, something researchers call reconsolidation. Consider flashbulb memories. Flashbulb memories are memories where we were when something really important happened, like JFK's assassination, shocking news in our personal lives, 9/11. Flashbulb memories are almost always very vivid and very clear, and we're absolutely confident that they are true. I know where I was when I heard about the attacks on the World Trade Center. I was at my son's elementary school. It was my youngest son's first full day of kindergarten. And when I was walking him to class, my middle son's friend came running up to us and told us someone had flown a plane into the World Trade Center. I told him he must be mistaken. It must have actually been an accident. He told me he was sure. And I just dismissed it as a misunderstanding of a child. I didn't get to a radio or talk to another adult for a while. My oldest son was then in the fifth grade, and it was his first day putting up the flag, and I stood with him as he did it. Then on the way home, I turned on NPR, and that child had been right. And I suspect each of you who is old enough remembers exactly where you were that morning and have absolute confidence in that memory. And it turns out many of us are wrong. Memory researchers have known for decades that flashbulb memories transform and change while the person who remembers it is absolutely confident of their truth. So after 9/11, a group of researchers jumped at the chance to do a large flashbulb memory study. In the days after 9/11, 3,000 people in seven cities wrote down exactly where they were and what they felt when they heard about the attacks. It turned out after 1 year, only 63% of the memories were consistent with those original stories. After 3 years, it was only 50%. However, confidence in those memories remained absolutely high. It was so high that when some people in the study were given the sheets that they'd written right after 9/11, they said that they couldn't understand why they would have lied on that piece of paper. Our memories, flashbulbs and other sorts, transform in all sorts of ways. We place an incident in a new place or at a new time. We fuse things together. We lose details. We add details. We forget or mix up sources of information. We think we heard it on NPR. Instead, it was really the television, for example. In the 9/11 story, people changed where they were, the rooms they were in, the places they were. Many, many people, and maybe you have this too, believed that they saw the first plane fly into that first tower on 9/11. However, this footage was not released until the days after the attack. Somehow that memory of seeing that first attack became part of that first moment story. How people remembered their emotions about the attacks also changed over time. In the days and weeks after 9/11, most of us had many opportunities to tell the story about where we were. That's how we bonded together. That's how we connected with other people in our shock. It was some way to talk about it. And each time we told those memories, we changed it a bit. That's just what people do. As we added emotion and meaning, we fleshed it out so it made more sense to us and to our audience. I've been telling stories in worship for years. I work really hard to find a story that goes with the theme of the service. But when I practice it and I tell it, something amazing happens. It shifts and transforms. Unconsciously, I will add a detail or leave something out or emphasize a different point in ways that draw the story closer to the theme of the service. For me, it's like creative magic. I just am infused with the theme, and somehow, with no forethought, out of my mouth comes this differently shaped story. And I suspect when we retell the stories of our lives, it is a similar process. Each time we tell a story, we shift it so that it fits our current mood and perspective, our new circumstances, our new audience. We add things that happened at different times or even with different people. We have Aunt Mindy relate something that happened on Thanksgiving Day when really it was Aunt Trudy who made that statement 3 years before at a birthday party. We create memories that reflect who we are when we retell it. So I want to pause for a moment. I'm talking about normal memory, and I want to say something about traumatic memory. We remember traumatic things that happen to us differently than non-traumatic memories. Traumatic memories get stuck in us, in our bodies, and they replay visually, auditorily, emotionally, physically. They come in shards, and they bite, and they hurt. We recently heard a very intense retelling of a traumatic memory by Christine Blasey Ford. How we process traumatic memories, how we work with them, and the ways they shift and do not shift is not the topic of this sermon. While there are commonalities, I don't want anything I say to help you make sense or judge traumatic memory in your own self or in other people's stories. That said, some memory can be really intense without rising to the definition of traumatic memory. Oliver Sacks, the renowned neurologist, relates such a memory in his autobiography of living in London during World War II as a boy. On another occasion, an incendiary bomb, a thermite bomb, fell behind our house and burned with a terrible white hot heat. My father had a stirrup pump, and my brothers and I carried pails of water to him. But water seemed useless against this internal fire. Indeed, it made it burn even more furiously. There was a vicious hissing and sputtering when the water hit the white hot metal. And meanwhile, the bomb was melting in its own casing and throwing blobs and jets of molten metal in all directions. The description is really vivid, right? A first-person assessment of what happened. However, when his brother Michael read the autobiography, he told Sacks that it wasn't true. Sacks wasn't there when the bomb fell behind their house. Still, Sacks remembered it vividly. How could that be? Michael told him they had been in the country when the incident happened, and their older brother had sent them a very detailed letter about it. Sacks had been obsessed with the letter. Somehow, over the years, he took the details in the letter for his own memory. And Sacks, who you know is a neurologist who thinks hard about these things, tried to feel any difference in the way he remembered this implanted memory compared with the ones that had actually happened to him. And he could in no way tell the difference, which is true across studies, actually. There is a similar story about Brian Williams, a newscaster, who over years of relating an intense story of an emergency helicopter landing during the Iraq invasion, conflated his own experience with another helicopter in his group that had taken enemy fire. In his first reports of the event, he shared the story that was shared by other people's recollections. He was in the helicopter behind the one that took enemy fire. But in an interview years later, he said he was in the helicopter that took enemy fire. People were outraged that he lied, and he lost his job. And he was mystified. He had the memory. It really felt real to him. Memory researchers, however, were not mystified. Williams had gone through a normal human process of memory shifting and transformation as a story that felt close to his emotional experience became part of who he was. I wonder who remembers brick making more factually, my mother or I. I suppose we could talk to the other six people involved in that brick making nearly 45 years ago and get their stories and come to some possible idea of what actually happened, or perhaps not. Elizabeth Loftus, a memory researcher, talks about happening truth, which is the bare facts, and story truth, which is the story you tell yourself about what happened. In my story, happening truth was my family made bricks out of dirt and cement in the summer. And then I got cement in my eye, and there was a lake that we swam in. Story truth is everything else my mother and I say about it. Because it doesn't really matter exactly what happened all those years ago. What matters is the stories we have told ourselves about that time in our life and how they have made us who we are now. I think about the memory I have of the third grader telling me about the attacks on the World Trade Center. In it, I corrected him, assuming he got his information wrong. Later, I discovered I was the one who was wrong. Why is that the story that I tell? Why is it the one that I remember that comes up over and over? Why don't I tell the story about holding the flag as my son unfurled it, how we pulled it to full mast, and when I returned to pick my children up later, it was a half mast? What does that story that I have chosen to tell me about myself? Well, in the memory I have, I was really chagrined that I had corrected someone who was and said they were mistaken when what they said was true. And I think perhaps I need a story that shows that every person carries pieces of truth. And that is something that I've carried through in my life. One has to wonder, though, what is the purpose of human memory when it does not seem to have evolved to give us precise data and facts from the past? What does it mean that memories change, bringing together pieces from other times and places, forgetting the sources of the things that we know? What does it mean when we can easily make another's memories our own? My theology is relational. I believe we are of each other, more deeply influencing and connecting together than our modern individualistic culture recognizes. That's why I believe in love, because it is a relational way of interacting with the world. Neuroscience has been showing us that we are related in ways we never understood before. For example, when we watch somebody do something, our brain does not distinguish from watching and doing it ourselves. The same things light up either way, if you're sweeping the floor or watching someone sweep the floor. Half our brains are formed in relationship with our caregivers and cultures. We come with only half of our mind and brain formed, in fact. And memories seem to be no different. Memories seem to be relational, formed by our relationships to others and our lived experience and the stories we tell. Science has shown us that memory was never designed through the evolutionary process to relate objective truth or facts, but to make sense of our lives creatively and in relationship with others. In a culture that believes in objective truth and intellectual property, This is revolutionary and paradigm changing. In our culture's understanding of how things work, both Sachs and Williams did something terrible and wrong, even though it was unconscious. However, it seems that they both did what humans are made to do. They took the important stories of their families and their communities, and they made them their own. My mother and I shared an experience, but we don't have the same memories. And this also seems to be what humans are made to do. We each have the capacity to make stories that explain our lived experience, even if facts shift. I have to admit that it makes me really anxious, contemplating the flexibility and creativity of memory. Where is the truth, then? How do we know anything if memory is unreliable? It makes me consider that maybe truth isn't something hard and solid that we can know, but perhaps truth is always something that is coming into being. Perhaps truth itself is never solid, not something that once was, not definitive, clear, factual. It's a puzzle that forms and reforms, a story with new characters and plot twists. It's an ever-changing painting. So what does it mean to be a people of memory? What does it mean to be a person of memory? Maybe it means to be a people who know our story and know that our story from the past and from the future is always becoming something that means more and guides us on to where we are going and who we are supposed to be.